Hello and welcome back to the True Travel Podcast with me, Laura Sanders. This week we're heading to the Atlas Mountains in Morocco to hear from Alice Morrison, a British author who's lived out there for 8 years and is a self-proclaimed Indiana Jones for girls. You'll soon find out why as she tells us of her adventures across the Sahara Desert, encountering snakes, quicksand and even lost kingdoms. During this episode, I'll be asking her about one of her most recent expeditions following the 1,500-kilometre Drar River from source to sea with two nomadic men and their camels. Alice gained exclusive access to the nomadic communities along the way and was able to speak to the women of the families and find out what nomadic life is really like. Alice also tells us what life is like in her compound in the mountains and how she's become the adoptive crazy aunt there. A huge thank you to all of you who've listened so far. This week, the True Travel Podcast hit 1,000 downloads, so that's amazing. Thank you so much, and I hope you're enjoying it as much as I am making this podcast. Don't forget, you can see more from my guests over on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook by searching the True Travel Podcast. And if you haven't already, make sure you're subscribed so you know when a new episode drops. Alice, it's so lovely to meet you. Thanks for coming on. You've been fasting for Ramadan at the moment, haven't you? How are you feeling? How is it over there?
Well, it's lovely to be on your podcast. Thank you for inviting me. And it's 3 minutes past six and 20 seconds in Morocco, which means I have 1 hour and 2 minutes until we break the fast. So I'm still fasting. So I haven't eaten or drunk anything since 4:25 this morning. And I think it's quite difficult for people to get their heads around, because until you've done it, honestly, and myself totally included in this, you don't understand what that's like. So everyone in Morocco, more or less, I mean, from age about 13 upwards, is fasting at the moment. So I'm one of 1.6 billion people worldwide. But it's really an effort. And I think it's one of those things, isn't it? You know, you've got a religion where everybody's fasting for a whole month and it's genuinely difficult. You know, your brain goes to mush, you're very thirsty, you're very hungry, you get a headache, you feel slightly flu-y. But it's also a time of, they call it like the holy month and the celebratory month. So once you break the fast, everyone does it together and you feel wonderful. And it's being part of a community and feeling that community in quite a visceral way, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not something you really get over here. You know, we've just had Easter, but no one really gives anything up for Lent. I mean, you're supposed to, but you don't. So it's a very, I imagine it really brings you all together, doesn't it? I mean, you've got your neighbours there. And I imagine, you know, once you break that fast, it's very much, oh, what are you having to eat? And that celebratory thing, like you say. I mean, I do sympathise. You look very well on not eating all day, I must say. And you sound like you make sense. So that's good.
That's really nice.
Yeah, it must be so tough. So are you allowed to even sip water?
No water. That's the hardest thing. So it's kind of nil by mouth. And the whole point of Ramadan, there's lots of different parts. And I'm not actually a Muslim. I am doing it because I live in a family compound and I want to fit in with the community. And here it's very important to people. So I know everyone in my village and everyone's like, how are you? What are you doing? What are you up to? And then they all ask me, are you fasting? And when I came to Morocco, I didn't used to fast because I lived in the city and I always felt it put a barrier up between me and the people I was talking to. And I'm not used to that barrier because I'm used to being very much part of the community. So I didn't like it. And I felt uncomfortable during the whole month. So I gave in. I surrendered. And that's actually what Islam means, is to surrender. So I surrendered. I'm not a Muslim, but I thought, right, I'll fast. And what it's brought me is that closeness to the people I live with. And it's honestly worth it. And I do understand, and one of the things for Ramadan is it's meant to make you think about people in the world who don't have enough to eat regularly and don't have enough water regularly, like this is part of their daily lives. And of course, as a Scot, as a Westerner, I've never actually been hungry because I couldn't afford food ever. And so this Ramadan kind of at least makes you think about what it's like to go for a whole day without any food. And honestly, you know, you can't think properly, you're hungry, your breath stinks. And to understand that people in the world habitually go through life without enough to eat. I mean, I will eat tonight and I'll be fine. I'll have enough calories and I'll feel great. But there are people in the world, obviously, who don't. So honestly, I think that is one of the things I really take from Ramadan, is to understand that in a more at a more basic level, at a physical level. So it's good from that point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hats off to you for doing it, even though you're not Muslim, you know, to fit in and to understand what your neighbours are going through. That's great. And I think as well, you know, at work where I work, we have signs up saying, oh, some of your colleagues are fasting, but that doesn't really help you to understand. I mean, you try to understand what they're going through, but to hear from you, to hear from somebody who's actually going through it and describe it, I think it really gives some insight. So yeah, anyway, you're looking good on it. So you spoke a little bit then about your compound, and just before we start recording, you showed me around your adorable house and the beautiful mountainscapes outside and your cats. So just tell us where exactly you're calling from, what it's like, and how many people are living in your compound.
So I live in a small village in the Atlas Mountains of Morocco, which is in the central belt of Morocco. The Atlas Mountains are very high. The highest peak in North Africa is kind of about 10 miles away, and it's called Mount Toubkal at 4,167 meters, which is more than three times the height of Ben Nevis. So it's a very beautiful mountainous scenery, very barren. I live in a very lush valley, but the mountains themselves are very magnificent, steep and peaked. And I came to live here nearly 4 years ago and found this little place. And I've got a very small house on top of my neighbor's front room, and then underneath them is the cow. So I live above the family cow and look out onto the chickens. And the way people live here is within families. So I'm the kind of adopted crazy aunt in this extended family. And there are four couples, four husbands and wives, all their children living in the compound. And we have a shared yard and a door at the end. In fact, a door at the top and a door at the bottom where the cow is. And it's a very safe environment. It's also very appropriate for the culture, where women and men socialize, for example, separately. And so the women in this compound can, you know, go around their daily business. We're all together, and they don't have to wear a veil or anything like that because they're within their own homes. If I ever bring, I have to be a bit wary. So if a friend comes to visit and it's a male, or if one of the guides comes to visit me or whatever, I always just have a little check around that nobody, no females in the compound are out and would be perturbed by a strange man that coming in and seeing them in their home environment. So it's kind of like I've got my own small house, which I love, and this fantastic view, but we're also all interlinked. You know, the four homes are here. I eat dinner with my neighbors during Ramadan. We're always out chatting to each other. So it's a very lovely, for me, it's a very lovely communal life, but at the same time, I have all my privacy. So I think I'm pretty lucky.
Yeah, it's really interesting that, and lovely to hear as well. You know, you've got a real sense of community, because I think even in the UK, even in a block of flats, you don't have that sense of community like you're describing there. And, you know, I don't know how to ask this exactly, but what exactly is a compound? Because it's something quite unique to this part of the world, isn't it? You know, it's somewhere between a block of flats and a house.
It's kind of an odd word to use. I suppose in America we'd be a gated community. But basically, there's four houses, and then my little kind of, it's a house. I've got my own door, but it's only on one floor, and it's above another house. I guess I'd be a flat in a way. And then we have this central area that is all that we share. And then at the end, there's a wall and a gate. So basically, the four houses all look inwards onto the yard, and then we have a gate at the end, and some of the houses are built into the rock of the mountain, because here the houses are built, the rock can be one of the walls, because of the way that, you know, you kind of scrape out bits of land and terraces into the mountainsides.
Fantastic. It all sounds very idyllic and rural, particularly with the cow living underneath you.
Yes, you'll probably hear her later on, because she gets very loud when she wants to be milked or fed.
Brilliant. So you've been there for what, did you say 4 years?
Yes, I can't believe it. I've been here nearly 4 years.
Gosh, and what led you to moving there originally?
Well, I've been in Morocco for 8 years altogether, and I was living in Essaouira, which is a beautiful coastal city, really lovely beside the beach. I had lots of friends. It was really nice. And then I signed up to run the Everest Trail Race, which is a 6-day ultra marathon when you actually run around Everest. And of course, you have to train for something like that. And you can't train for a mountain race at the seaside, because I knew I'd be running at altitude. So I decided to move to this area in order to train for that race. So I packed everything up, got a lorry, hired, you know, got the mules ready at the other end to carry all my stuff up the hill, and I moved. And I've been here ever since. I really like living here. I travel a lot. So I do expeditions, which typically take anything from, you know, a month and a half to 3.5 months. So I'm away for long periods of time. And this feels like the kind of safe haven to come home to.
Oh, fantastic. And what did people think when you first moved in there? What did they think? Who is this strange white woman moving into our compound? Or were they quite welcoming or intrigued?
All of those things. So when I first moved, so everything here is done all together. You know, if you're a very private individual person, this is not the place for you at all. You have to, that you won't enjoy it. You'll just feel constantly pressurized. Whereas I actually love, you know, I love people knowing what I do and being interested in what I do and being interested in me, and I'm interested in them. I love all that stuff. So for me, it suits me. And also I am allowed my privacy here. You know, they're very respectful. But when I moved in, and about eight, one of my friends here, a guide, helped me find the place. And when I moved in, he came to help me with about eight men from the village and a mule to carry all my stuff up. So there were all these people traipsing through, and then my landlord came in, Haj Ibrahim, who is so nice. And he was like, just before we get going, there are three rules: no men, no parties, and no sunbathing in your bikini on the roof. And I was like, oh my God, he has such an amazing vision of what my life is, because there are no men, there are no parties, and there's definitely no sunbathing on the roof. So that was his thing. So I think I understood very early on that to fit in, to be part of this community, I have to adapt myself. Not completely, I don't have to change completely, but you know, there has to be some, so there has to be, like, both sides have to approach each other. And so when I first moved in, I did certain things, like I left my door open. I went to greet everybody. I made sure, and this was a bit difficult at the beginning because I was training as well. But when I wasn't in training kit, which is very immodest by the standards here, it's like basically going out in a thong. If you go out in your leggings and a t-shirt, unfortunately. But I would wear a jalaba, you know, a kaftan. And one of the things that, there were two things that really helped me here. And the first thing was that my landlord's mother, Al-Hajja, who was in her 90s, took a real shine to me, and I took a real shine to her. And I speak a little bit better now, but I spoke very basic Tashlahit, which is the language here, but enough to, you know, say hello and welcome. And every single day she would come up to my house and she'd bring me an apricot, or she knew I loved this kind of bread, she'd bake me this bread. And she was such a beautiful person. She was tiny and frail, but really warm. She had really, everything about her was warm. Her hands were warm, and she'd totter up, climb up the steps, and she'd come into my house and she'd say in Tashlahit, Tigmi Ibrahim Tashweet, which means the house that Ibrahim, her son, built is very beautiful. And of course I'd agree with her because it is lovely. And then we'd sit on the terrace and hold hands. And I think, I know, and because we just took, you know, sometimes you just click with people, and because we really took to each other. And she is the matriarch. She's the grandmother of everybody in this Doar, and the mother of the men. That really opened a door for me, because she opened up to me. So that was number one. And then the second thing that happened was I was training. So I was doing, you know, sport. And there was one day very early on, it was very hot, actually. It was July. So it was really, really baking. And I was like, oh God, I've got to go out. And I was trying to do weighted step ups. So I had 15 kilograms in my backpack. And then I had to go up a high step and down to strengthen my legs. And the only place I could do it was outside. So I thought, I'm going to have to do this. I know everyone's going to think I'm totally mad, but you know, I've got to train for this race. This is a really good exercise. So I went out in my lycra tights and top, and I just started stepping up, step down, step up, step down, step up, step down, kind of semi-running. And as I was doing it, all the kids from the Doar, kind of who were on school holidays at the time, congregated behind me. And then, and also Fatima, my landlady, who's about the same age as me, she came up, and Nezha came, a hefty dove from next door came. And so all the women and kids were sitting there watching me. And then they started to join in. And as they joined in, I started counting in Arabic, Wahid Jewish Let Arba. And we were doing this thing together. And we all did this exercise together to a certain extent. And everyone was falling about laughing. They thought it was hilarious, but they loved doing it, especially the kids. They absolutely loved doing the sport. And then at the end, this is my top tip to anyone who moves to a strange country, get yourself a store of lollipops. At the end, we all had a celebratory lollipop, the women and the children. And that was it. I think that just cracked. That just cracked it, really, because it made everything approachable, you know. So I think those two things, the Hajja, the lovely grandmother, and also just doing sport with the kids and the mums, that just cracked it. That cracked the whole relationships wide open, and it's gone from strength to strength.
Oh, amazing. And I think you've got a good point there. I think anywhere you go, if you find things that are icebreakers in any country, then you're going to be fine, you know, whether it's a silly dance or a bit of exercise or lollipops, you know, it's just those little things that make us human at the end of the day. And if you're going to be open and warm, then you're going to have no problem. And I think generally travelers are like that, because if you don't want to be like that, then you're not going to enjoy traveling the world. So that's really great. That's lovely. So you call yourself the Indiana Jones for girls, which I absolutely love.
Do you? It's slightly wanky. I'm not sure whether I should take it off, but people kind of get it.
I do. I mean, just from looking at where you live and the bits that you've told me so far, I'm like, yes, I get that. I love it. It's great. So you've written books, you've presented for the BBC, you've done all sorts of things, and you know, told people about your incredible adventures. And your most recent book, I believe, is Walking with Nomads. Have I got that right?
You have. Oh, thank you for giving me a little plug. Yes. So Walking with Nomads is a book about my adventure across Morocco. I walked 4,000 to 4,500, we're not quite sure how many, kilometres over 7.5 months from the very northernmost part of the country all the way down through the Sahara into the border with Mauritania. And I did it with 6 camels. Of whom my favorite is Hamish the camel, and the 3 Amazigh, which is the correct name for Berber, 3 Amazigh guides. So we walked this incredible distance and did this incredible adventure. And the book's about that. So the book has got all these things about finding a lost city, finding dinosaur footprints, escaping death by quicksand. I'm not even joking. Walking through landmines for 10 days. That was very stressful. And it's also about all the people that I meet, the nomads that I meet. It's about witnessing climate change. You know, I walked through a world that is drying up. Our area is drying up. Everything is dying, actually. And so walking through that week after week was a very different experience from hearing about climate change statistics on the telly. So I think I witnessed that, I felt it, and I hope I bear witness to it in the book. And so the book is a mixture of Indiana Jones for girls and also the daily routine of life. And I hope that in the book, if you read it, you also get to know a lot about the true Morocco and Africa, North Africa, the heart of Africa, and the Sahara, which is this incredible kind of character in the book, because it's so big and it's so all-encompassing and it's so fierce and it's so beautiful, and it's so blooming difficult. I tell you, the Sahara is difficult. And meeting the nomads there, being able to talk to the women as well, because I speak the languages and because I am a woman, is something that I think a lot of male adventurers can't do. They're not allowed access to women like I, you know, they're just not allowed to. So I feel that I've been able to bring that, and I hope I've been able to record that and witness it and hopefully tell the stories. And really, it's not just my story. It's also the story of Addi and Brahim, who were with me for the whole 7.5 months. These amazing men who I got to know so well. Addi, very naughty, 23, son of a nomad himself, was brought up to sheep and goats. He's illiterate, but he knows everything about everything. And, you know, if you look at an expedition where I've got like a degree and a postgraduate, and I would say I'm educated to a very high degree, and then there's Addy, who has none of those things. Which one of us do you think was most useful?
I'm gonna go with Addy.
Definitely not me. Exactly. So it just I think doing these kind of adventures, it really gives you a whole different perspective on life. And it's incredibly, even just remembering, I feel like I can feel my whole kind of life force is strengthening up. It's so exciting and so boring. It's everything. Everything is big and wide and brilliant, while at the same time being very detailed. So I thrived on those adventures, and the book's about that.
It's very much Indiana Jones for girls. I think you've certainly earned that label.
Thank you. I mean, as you can imagine, you do feel a bit stupid saying it, but it's trying to give people an idea. You know, I did find dinosaur footprints. I did uncover scorpions. There were snakes. There is a lost city. So, you know, what can I tell you?
The shoe fits.
Hopefully.
So I just want to delve into that a little bit. I mean, there's so much that you've mentioned. It's fantastic. But first off, what made you want to do this expedition?
I was looking for a new adventure. You know, adventurers have got to adventure. And I kind of signed my emails adventurer. So I'm constantly striving for that, to be authentic, to be what I say I am. And I was looking for one in Morocco where I was living. And I thought, well, I'll start off with the Dra, which is the longest river in Morocco, because it's a very, you know, geographically, the Dra River, a river makes sense, source to sea. You kind of understand it. It's a journey. People follow it. And actually, I think I became the first woman in the world ever to accomplish walking the Dra River. You know, I say that, the first recorded woman, because you never know, do you? I mean, you know, it could be a Stone Age woman that did it twice there and back. I don't know. So I started off with that. And then when I completed that expedition, I just wasn't ready to leave. I specifically wasn't ready to leave Adi and Brahim. I'll be honest. You know, we'd bonded so tightly and I felt so close to them and so much. We were such a little team, and also Hamish the camel. But we were all, we'd gone through such a lot together and had such an incredible experience together that I wasn't ready to stop. And so Jean-Pierre, who that Chari from Dardave, from Désert et Montagne Maroc, who organized my expedition, he was like, well, look, join up, do the north part, do the south part, and you'll have walked the whole of Morocco. So I was like, excellent idea. Let me just do that. So that's how it came about. I find often with my ventures, they're kind of progressions.
Amazing. What gave you this real travel bug to start with? I mean, did you grow up going on adventures, or was it, you know, one trip in particular that set it off?
Yeah, I mean, it has been a progression, but I was, when I was 6 weeks old, my mum did her law final exams at Edinburgh University she had me on May 25th. If anyone wants to remember my birthday, very welcome presents. I love them. And then on June, like, 6 weeks later, 2 weeks later, she did her law final exams. So she was quite a woman, passed. And then 4 weeks after that, she and my dad got on a boat and sailed to Africa. And I was brought up in Uganda, in the East Africa, overlooking the Ruwenzori Mountains, the Mountains of the Moon. So I think, truthfully, the kind of love of everything that I do now stemmed from those times, from those very earliest years. Even though later on I came back to Britain, you know, I had a normal job. I worked for the BBC. I was a journalist. I was an editor. I was the editor of a huge ISP. And then I was the CEO of a media development company. So I had a big career and a big life in Britain. But I guess, I don't know, I think I've circled back. And I've circled back to all those things that made the earliest impressions. So if you have young children, think about that.
Oh, I certainly will be. Don't you worry. They'll be traveling the world. That's incredible, though. It seems, as you say, like you've done a full circle, and it's almost like you had the big job and all of that in the UK, but you've come back to simplicity in a way, haven't you? And the things that bring you the most joy.
That's a really perceptive comment. I hadn't really thought about that, but actually that is totally true. I might have to take that as mine from now on. Thank you, Laura.
You heard it here first. No, but it's true. I mean, you showed me outside your window. I mean, how can you have a bad day looking at that view, really? I mean, it beats, you know, working in stuffy London or anything. Yeah, fantastic. So back to walking with nomads then. You know, nomadic people are quite mysterious to a lot of us, and you see them being depicted in a certain way in films. But what's it really like? What are those communities really like? What are they about? What was it like to get to know them?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, I called the book Walking with Nomads partly because I was walking with Addi, who is a nomad, and partly because I was walking through nomadic communities and we were meeting a lot of nomads. You know, forgive me for, you know, making broad generalizations and stereotyping, but I will try to answer your question in a way that makes it a bit more meaningful for people. But of course, every single individual in the world is different. So, you know, I'm just giving you generalizations to for a bit of understanding. So first of all, there are different nomadic communities in different physical landscapes. And that was very interesting for me. The nomads of the mountains are very, very different from the nomads of the desert. In very basic ways. So the nomads in the desert, the Sahrawis, they are camel herders, and they live in a desert environment, and they have different rules and regulations. So, for example, the women in the nomadic communities in the desert don't bake bread because they eat a lot of rice, or they go to the local, they're often split nowadays. The women will live in the town with their children because their children have to go to school, and the men will live in the desert with the camels, and they'll come back at weekends or for weeks, or spend some time in their tent and some time in another tent. Whereas the women in the mountains and the nomads here have a much harder life. I think it's partly climate, because in the mountains here, there's a long winter from November till, well, it's still cold now, so November till the end of March, and it's very, very cold, sub-zero, you're living in a tent. The women of some tribes, all the tribes are different, some tribes also herd the goats and the sheep. So in the mountains, it's goats and sheep, in the desert, it's camels. So a big difference is the nomadic women of the mountains are so tiny and skinny and lithe and so energetic and fit because they're running up and down the mountains all the time. And they also, bread is their staple diet. So they bake the bread every day. They look after the flocks. So each nomadic community has got a different life. But I would say the nomads in the mountains who I've spent more time with, even the Sahrawis, their life is very, very, very hard. It's very beautiful. The families do everything together. They live together. They care for each other. They are their own. They sleep together in the same tent, the mother and father and children. They do everything together. The children have such a beautiful, free upbringing. I mean, they're running around there with the animals. There is such an understanding of animals and what they're for. And if you eat meat, what that means, you know, what that actually means, you're killing that animal. And everything, the environment, the care that is taken, the things that we talk about in the West, but which we don't do particularly well, I think the nomads do beautifully. They are at one with the world. They leave no footprint. They live this extremely kind of noble, in a way, life where they're just living. They're not being greedy. They're living a very simple life. They're religious. They look after their families. But of course, and they're a good fun. They are a hoot. You have such a laugh because everybody's quite playful because people have more time as well. You know, it's a much different, you're not constantly bombarded with stuff. So people have more time. And after the day's work's done, most people, like a lot of people, you'll see them just going and sitting on the mountainside looking at the view because it's so beautiful. So there's all these things that go on. And then at the same time as saying all of that and painting this very kind of like noble, beautiful picture, it's so hard, and everybody doesn't want it for their children because it's too hard. It's too hard to be cold all the time. And when I'm talking about cold, you know, very, very, very cold all the time. When your teeth hurt, there is no dentist. Food is sparse. You're existing often for breakfast, they'll have bread and sweet tea. And then they might have like goat's milk yogurt or sheep yogurt during the day. And then they'll have a meal at night, which again would be bread with vegetable stew. I mean, you're not eating huge amounts of food. You're kept going a lot by sugar and by bread and by, as I say, vegetables, and then sometimes meat. When somebody gets sick, there's no doctor. If, you know, once I was with a family of nomads, and the grandmother was really, she had a terrible cold and she was ill. And it was freezing and there was no comfort for her. There was no medicine. There were no, you know, there was no Lemsip. She was just cold and sick and having to walk 20 kilometers a day. And it was very tough. So I think I don't want to over romanticize it for people. I see this beauty in the life, and I see the beauty in the people who are so hospitable and open and generous and funny and friendly. But at the same time, it's really tough, and they don't want it to continue. So I think the nomadic way of life is dying out now, because schooling is mandatory. So the children have to go to school. And of course, when they go to school and with the everyone's got a mobile phone, they see how other people live. And honestly, I think most people would choose an easier life. Truly, I do. I would. Much as I love this life, I also want to, I also want my electric blanket when I go to sleep here, because it's blooming, you know, it is minus. There's no central heating. And I've got the luxury of an electric blanket. I don't want to suffer from cold and suffer from hunger. And I don't want anyone else to either. So I think that that way of life is changing.
That's really interesting, because you don't often think about that. You know, like I say, you see them depicted in films and in photos, travel photography a lot, even National Geographic, as, you know, having this real ideal rural at one with nature. Yeah. Way of life. Yeah. And I suppose there's a happy balance, really. I mean, we're all here with our phones and, you know, being pinged all the time and think, oh, you know, I'd love a simpler life. But then, you know, you wouldn't want to say goodbye to things like medicines and heating and food. So, yeah, that's really interesting, really insightful. And as a woman as well, you've got that exclusive access. You're able to talk to the women of the family. What was that like? Because, you know, like as you say, males can't talk, so males can't ask questions and find out what it's like.
But one of the things that always made me laugh is, imagine the scene. So we've got our six camels. Hamish is the lead camel. Hunter was the second camel. We've got six camels in a string. We've got the three guides. And in the Sahara section, it was Addy and Brahim. And then Lahu, who's a bit older, who's in his 60s. And there's me, and we're trudging along. And in the distance, we had to beg the nomads for water in the Sahara. This part of the book is trying to survive, you know, get water. And the nomads always had water. So when we saw a tent, we would head for it because we'd need to redo our supplies. And no nomad, even if they only had a very little for themselves, would ever turn you away completely empty-handed. So you'd always get at least kind of 5 liters so that we could drink. And sometimes, you know, they would let us water our camels, and then we'd fill up everything. Anyway, we're walking. So we see a white tent in the distance. We're walking up through the Sahara. It takes us, I don't know, 3 hours to get there. And as we're approaching, Lahu yells at me. They call me Zahra here. So Zahra, get to the front. So I trot up. And he's like, Zahra, quick, get to the front. You are the key. And what he means is they as men cannot approach a tent, because it's more than likely it'll be the women in the tent and the men will be out working. And they literally can't approach a tent as men without causing great consternation to the women inside. Honestly, there is a danger. You're in the desert on your own as a woman. That there is a danger for men. Let's be honest about this, truthfully. And even if there's no danger, it's culturally, you know, abandoned. So I trotted up to top, went into the tent, was talking to these lovely two women that we met. They put the tea on. I was asking all about things, which I'll tell you about shortly. But suddenly then I hear Lahu going, Zahra, get out of here. So I zip out of the tent. And there's a large man with a large stick running towards the men, you know, ready to give them a right old whack, because he'd assumed that they were invading his women's home. And then, of course, I arrived. I'm like, no, they're with me. It's fine. I'm a girl. Look, it's all good. And everything calmed down. And then we all went in. Then the men were also allowed into the tent because their husband was back, and we all had tea. So I think that gives you an insight into the way the communities here, or there, I should say, works in a completely different way. But talking to the women, so say for the example of the Sahara, I mean, every woman again is different, but what I found universal was the women were very concerned about things like education for their daughters, obviously marriage, And the questions they would ask me are always, are you married? Why not? Do you have, you don't have children? Why don't you have children? Why have you taken this? Why are you walking? Why aren't you at home with the husband and children? And so their lives are very much centered around the home and the family. And they, it wasn't that they would, well, they were judging me, actually, to be honest, they were judging me, but it was more that it was beyond their comprehension, because for them, you know, the women are raised to, they want to get married and have children. That's their life. But now the girls are getting educated. And so I met one very interesting young woman along the path, and she came zipping out. She was with her granddad for a week. So this, again, was quite common in Sahara. She lived in Dakhla, which is a big town there. But she'd come back out to her grandfather, who lived all the time with his herds, for a week, to spend a week in her heritage. But it's not like they do like a week a year. They'll go regularly. And she said, I said, how are you enjoying it? She said, well, actually, I'm quite bored because, you know, my friends were, she was about 20, or she was very pretty and 20, and she spoke English and Italian, as well as Hassaniya, which is her dialect, and Arabic. And she said, you know, no, I want a different life. She said, I get bored. I want to come back and be with my family and be with my grandfather and help with the camels. And, you know, I enjoy the life here in the desert, but for me, my life now is in the town and it's more modern, and I'm looking to the future. And I, you know, I'm educated. I need more than this. So things are really changing, as I said.
That's really interesting, a really interesting insight there, and really unique insight. And I suppose in a way, you know, we look at women in this part of the world as not having much power, but actually, I think they've got power. I think you've got power. You certainly have power in that situation. You know, without you showing your face, your men would have been whacked by a stick, and you were the one that had to go in and ask for the water, you know? So I do think there is power in being a woman in this part of the world, and it's often not looked at that way. But really interesting.
Yeah, I think you've brought up a really important point, and it's a controversial point, and I might not get this right for everybody, but I would like to put an alternate view, and you've been very perceptive. The society here is very structured. So men have a role and women have a role, and both those roles are very set. So whether you're a man or a woman, you have rules that you have to follow. So just as the women have rules that they have to follow, the men do as well. And they're quite strict. You know, here, for example, it's not at all cool for guys to sleep around. It's like, it really, they were considered dirty. It's not, you know, like guys bragging down the pub about how many women they've had. That just is like off the table. What men here have to provide. So, you know, you might want to spend your life, I don't know, being a poet, but it's not going to happen. You're going to have to provide for your family, for your mother and your father, also for your wife and your children, as a man. So just to say that the roles are very strict, and that both men and women have roles to fulfill. The women's role, which we often see as a very negative thing in this society, I think what I'd like to just highlight for people is the other side of it, in that women here are absolutely taken care of. Women, my neighbors really pity me because I don't have a man to help me. I don't have someone to go and do my shopping for me, to change the gas cylinder, to do all these things that they don't have to do. Their role is to look after the house, do the cooking, look after the children. And I know that sounds really sexist to people. I'm just reflecting a reality of the society. So when they see me cooking, don't have any children, looking after the cats, and cleaning and working and going to the market and having to, you know, get everything sorted in my life, they really pity me. They feel truly sorry for me, which I think is interesting. They don't envy me my freedom. They're like, what's it for? You haven't got anything. You haven't got a husband or children. What's this freedom for? And it's not that they don't like me or don't respect me, but they're like, they don't want what I have. Whereas, you know, in our society, freedom to do things is what we crave. So the women here are very cared for in that way. And again, I'm generalizing, and of course there are poor, you know, I'm not talking about the very poor where it's very difficult for everybody, but women here would be given everything they needed, really, and they wouldn't be asked to go out. So the way it was explained to me by one of my guys, Brahim, was, he said, look, Alice, in our society, Zahra, in our society, a man is like a jalaba. He's like a jalaba for a woman. And a jalaba is the robe that the men wear here, and the women, with the long robe with the little hood at the back. And it covers you from the sun, and it covers you from the cold, and it keeps you warm, and it keeps you cool, and it protects you. And he says, a man has to be that for a woman. It's our job. So they find in our society where they see single parenthood, you know, young girls raising families on their own, women being attacked in the streets and murdered. I mean, that's the other side, that they look at our society and they go, what are you doing? You're not protecting your woman. So I think I'm just trying to give you a slight balance. It's not the whole story. We could talk all night about this. And I apologize if I've offended anyone, because I know people have very strong views about this. But there is absolutely a kind of duty of care here. And there's one more thing I want to mention, which is very important, which is the cult of the mother. So here, the mother is everything. And even in the Quran, it talks specifically, you have to say your mother's name 5 times before you say your father. The mother is 5 times or 3 times again. Oh, I haven't got that wrong. But basically, the mother is absolutely revered. When anyone comes in to see their mother, they kiss her hand, you know, in these traditional societies. And the mother is everything to everybody. So the role of the mother is on a huge pedestal. And there is an enormous power there, genuinely. And there is no, I have never, in traditional communities again, but I have, nobody disrespects their mother. It just, and the children all share in the work, boys and the girls share in the work. And they, you know, as soon as they can, they try and take the burden from their mother. The mother is such a powerful role. It really is. And so that's, again, I think an interesting counterpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. You've given us a real insight there. And I know you've wanted to be very careful about what you've said, but at the end of the day, it's what you've experienced, what you've seen, and you've seen something that a lot of us will never get to really see. So it's interesting. And yeah, I totally get what you say about the mother, your landlord's mother. Look at how she helps you integrate into your little community, because she's very well respected. So on this expedition, what surprised you the most? Is there anything that you went in with preconceptions of, and anything that particularly surprised you? Could have been about the environment, the landscape, the people you met, anything really?
Well, one of the things that was amazing to see was we went up, we didn't discover them for the first time, but we went to see these extremely rare. There's only about between 12 and 20 of them in the Dra River. And it's on the top of they're always set on top of a large flat hill. So you go up about 500 meters and then there'll be a plateau. And on them are these extraordinary Stone Age monuments, which I'd never heard of. And Jean-Pierre, my expedition organizer, found a reference to them in a reference book and found a location. So he came with me and we went on a kind of offshoot to the expedition. And when we got up, so we imagine that you're just walking through, we're in the valley of the Dras, so we're in a kind of a river valley, and then we climb 500 meters up and get onto this plateau. And on the top of this plateau are three shapes that are like, in French they call them antennae, but they're not antennae. They're about 250 meters long or wide, with about 150 meters on each side, and they're like giant wings or a boomerang. Imagine a boomerang shape with a round kind of head pyramid at the top. Looks like exactly like starships. They look exactly like spaceships. You know, when you see in Star Wars or Enterprise, you see like the little fighter ones going out that are shaped like boomerangs. That is exactly what these things look like. And they're built purely of rocks, these giant rocks and stones that have been gathered from the plain and brought up. They all face directly west towards the sunset. And they are funerary emblems. I don't know, funerary monuments. So they're like the pyramids. So you've got these extraordinary spaceships in the desert. And they really are, when you go, and of course, you know, you're miles from anyone, miles from anywhere. And you come across these gigantic things made by people in the Stone Age, you know, 4,000 years ago, just there on top of a plateau, just waiting for you to discover. And very little is known about them, really almost nothing. They are considered to be funerary. They face west. They're only found in the Dra and in some other parts of North Africa. So I think they're very much from this area, from the North African region. What are they? Why did they build them? When did they build them? What's the significance? Was it, I mean, you know, I'm like going, obviously they saw spaceships and they copied them. I mean, obviously they probably didn't, but it's all of those things. So when you're exploring in the way that I do, you have a chance to really try and think about things, because there isn't much information. So, you know, just try and work it out for yourself. And notice things. You have to notice things. So you notice the size of the stones, how they've been placed, the fact that they were absolutely, because we got some drone footage later, they're absolutely symmetrical. And yet these people could only have built them from the ground. So how did they get them? 4,000 years ago, absolutely symmetrical. So I think that kind of discovery on the expedition, there were a few things like that, all in the book, Walking with Nomads, she plugged. That kind of thing was very exciting and, yeah, just stimulates your imagination and makes you think, what was it for? Who were these people? What were they like? Were they like me? How did they carry them up? You know, some of those boulders were really big. So, that was the kind of exciting thing that we found.
Wow. And things like that, you often, you know, you've got Stonehenge in this country, you've got the Nazca lines, which are also a mystery.
Yeah.
And it is really fun to imagine, isn't it? And think how on earth did people lift that and get it so symmetrical, as you say? And I imagine what you saw was so, you know, far less visited and seen than, you know, those other places.
There's nobody there. Nobody goes there. I mean, that's the joy of it. It's like you do feel special, I guess, because you're witnessing something that you know that very, very few other people have seen.
That's amazing. I'm conscious that you are going to break your fast very soon, and I don't want to deprive you for another second of your dinner. So I will finish by asking you what you've got coming up next. Any exciting adventures on the horizon at all?
Well, I hope so. I've got plans to do keeping Morocco as my home, but doing a couple more adventures in the Middle East, because it's my area of interest, Middle East and Africa. And I don't know if I'm a specialist, but I do speak Arabic and I have spent a lot of time both in Africa and in the Middle East. So I'm hoping to do another, I just finished actually the Jordan trail. So I walked north to south of Jordan, and I'm hoping to do another. What I've got my eye on is I like crossing countries on foot. So I've got my eye on a couple. I kind of don't want to say which, because they're not far advanced enough yet, but hopefully you'll invite me on again and I can tell you all about it.
Yes, we'll keep an eye out and see what you get up to. But Alice, it's been fantastic speaking to you. What are you going to have for dinner? I'm intrigued now. I'm invested.
Well, when I was in Jordan, actually, so when you break your fast, so there's things that it's very interesting to me, at least, and what I've learned over the several times now I've done Ramadan, is that the first thing you do is you eat dates. So you eat either 1, 3, or 5 dates, and you drink soup. So the traditional soup to drink here is either white harira or red harira. White harira is just like porridge, very thin porridge. And red harira is a kind of vegetable soup with chickpeas and tomatoes and onions. And I've actually, tonight I've made a really delicious soup, which I learned about in Jordan, which is peas and chicken, very clear, so it's very light soup with peas, chicken, and some vermicelli, so some very thin noodles. So that is what I'm going to have with my dates, because those dates really help with everything, your hydration, your energy levels. And also we eat a very sweet pastry here called shabakia, which is basically you make a dough, you deep fry it, and then you dip it in honey. And my neighbor's just arrived with bread for my dinner. She's baked me some bread.
Go and eat your lovely bread and your soup. It was lovely to meet you, Alice. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
You enjoy your dinner.
Thank you.
Bye.